You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Happy Tuesday, everybody. How's it going, Canada? Beautiful country, beautiful people. We're all getting through, and everyone's doing well. Just a pleasure to be here today. We got a great show today on the day that Justin Trudeau is going to have a virtual face-to-face meeting with Joe Biden, the President of the United States. I'll talk about that. That's a big deal. It's a huge deal. I'll give you my take on that. The very good, the good, and the empty. The very good, the good, and the empty. And that's going to be a two-hour meeting with the president and the prime minister and then some of their cabinet ministers. And why does it matter to you is the question I always think about. Like, why do people care? Why should you care? But I was, thinking about the very good. I wanted to just depart before I get to the politics, which is always the main course. And you can hear me sort of crunching because, you know, our show starts Eastern time. If you're listening in Eastern Canada and Quebec and Ontario and maybe out West, it's a little different time zone there, obviously. But it's lunchtime. And today for lunch, I am eating for the second time my wife's famous, in our house, granola, which she makes and I devour. I'm the main. See, I eat cereal every single day of my life since my father, who turned, as you know, 89, he first discovered Cheerios on a visit to our relatives when he was about 13 in Detroit. And he ate a box of Cheerios in probably 1948 or something, or 1949 or something. And he's eaten Cheerios like every day in of his life since. We're breakfast cereal people. I could eat breakfast. I do a mix of breakfast cereal every day. Three or four different cereals with some fruit. That is my life. I love it. It's my favorite meal of the day. I love breakfast cereal. And I don't. And I know some people don't, but I could eat it every day. And then my wife has this recipe for granola, which includes, it's sweet, it's great, and she puts millet. I didn't even know what millet was. These little tiny little crunchy things, and they cook, and they're fantastic. I add that to the mix. And so for lunch today, I just said, I'm going back to that because it's, she doesn't make it all the time. But when she does, it's like my all-time favorite thing. So I've got the, and I don't know if you could just text me. This is completely off base. But is there one thing in your household that your partner or you make that is just, you just love it? Anyway, I always say to my wife, if she ever quits her job, which she's not going to do, she should just get into this granola because she gives it to people for Christmas and for Hanukkah and any time. And people say, I would eat this all day. It's like the greatest recipe ever. And I said, this is your career. Just go into the granola bit because I would eat it every day. Anyway, she's not. She's not. But anyway, just one of those things when I think of things that are very good in my life, and this is how crazy the pandemic is, eating granola, that homemade granola is like, it's right up there for me. And maybe that's a sign of how pathetic life is right now, that it's like, oh, I love life's so good. Why, I had a little bit of this homemade sweet granola. Okay, let's get to the very good, though. Very good that Justin Trudeau gets the first face-to-face meeting with the president. That's very good. Do not underestimate how important it is. Having the ear of the United States president, having a good relationship is very good. This is Canada's number one trading partner. We have lots of issues with the United States. We need a good relationship. And after 4 years of a lousy relationship with Donald Trump, even though we renegotiated NAFTA, it was tempestuous. It was a boiling pot on your stove. You never know if it was burning up. Donald Trump was one tweet away from everything going sour. This is good. Good that Joe Biden knows Justin Trudeau. Good that his last visit when he was the vice president under Obama was to Ottawa. They have a long relationship. They have a good relationship. They're simpatico. That's the very good. Okay? And that's good. Let's call that under very good. What's good? Well, it's good that they're simpatico on some fundamental issues. On NATO. On climate issues. Because you want to be aligned on anything with your most important trading partner. That's good, right? That's good because we have to deal with China, whether it's on the Olympics, on the potential genocide in Western China, whether it's on the two Michaels, the Meng Wanzhou. That's good that we've got the year, we got to work with them. Good. Here's where the empty starts. If you are expecting today to have Justin Trudeau walk out of that meeting at about 6 p.m. Eastern, where he's going to talk about a partnership roadmap, that's what's going to happen today. This is what they're all talking about today. A partnership roadmap on the future of Canadian-U.S. relationships, a blueprint, I'm quoting, for a whole-of-government relationship based on shared values and commitment and partnership. That's all good on the border on COVID. But let's get to show me the money. And here's where it's the very good, the good, and the empty shopping cart. One, we need vaccines. Are we going to get some from the Kalamazoo factory in Michigan, the Pfizer? Answer, no. Not now. Maybe once the U.S. is all vaccinated, but not now. So are we, the U.S. is practicing vaccine nationalism. Maybe you don't blame them, but we ain't going to be helped. So we're not getting vaccines from Joe Biden. So great guy, lovely guy, nice warm words, not parting with his vaccines. If you think the Keystone XL pipeline, which he killed, is coming back, he is not going to revisit the Keystone XL pipeline. Not coming back. You can say it's mutually guaranteed. Whatever argument you want. It's better oil than importing from any other country. We're the closest neighbors. You need it. Not coming back. There's another pipeline from Michigan, from Ontario to Michigan. Line 5. It's been there for decades. That may get, is that, are they going to have movement on that? No. Likely not. What about on China? Are the two? Is he going to drop charges for Meng Wanzhou to help release the two Michaels? We hope. Is there going to be news on that? No. There's a process there. China is a complicated issue for the United States. I hope he comes up with multilateral issues that we can work with the United States to press China to open up some transparency on what's going on against the Uyghurs, the potential genocide there, the horrors there, the crimes against humanity there. We've got to work with the U.S. Are we going to have something today? Probably not. Most importantly for you, for the economy, the United States is got a Buy American in their recovery. That means only American companies can bid on big, big, big state projects. Buy American. Is there going to be a Canadian exemption, as Justin Trudeau should and will push for? The answer we've heard yesterday from Biden's spokesperson is no. So the shopping cart is empty. The store is lovely. The future may be good. Maybe we got, but today we're going to probably come back with nothing on Buy American, nothing on vaccines, nothing on China. Nothing on pipelines. Now, will we talk about climate change and alignment in the future? Yes. Will we talk about maybe vaccines in the future? Yes. But not now. Very good, the good and the empty. Look. Look. It's great to have these meetings. But let's be clear. Joe Biden's a lovely guy. He's a warm and authentic guy. But he, like any leader, is about his country first. Do not be seduced by the warm and fuzzies. This is hard-nosed business. And you got to do business with the United States in a hard-nosed way. We should not be seduced by soft, fuzzy, warm words. Welcome, great, important, relationships matter. But as they used to say in the film, show me the money. Need to see vaccines. Need to see get rid of Buy American. Got to get rid of Buy American. Violates the new NAFTA anyway, so get rid of it. Help us out on China. Don't kill Line 5. There's lots to, there's material things. Now, what I'm going to do is pick up this conversation with Scotty Greenwood. She's the CEO of the Canadian American Business Council. And here's what we got to know today, folks. This is our biggest trading partner. This is going to be key to our recovery and your future economic health. Why does today matter to you? That's next.
When important decisions are made, we report. Here's Evan Solomon.
All right, welcome back to the program, everybody. So Trump. Biden Trudeau. Trump's done. Biden Trudeau. They're having the first bilateral meeting. Why do we never call that when you're like, I talked to my neighbor this morning, Jim. I came back from my run. Jim's out there scraping his car. Hey, Jim, how you doing, Ev? Why don't I call that a bilateral? I don't say I had a bilateral meeting with Jim. Says talk to Jim. Anyway, they're having a bilateral meeting, Biden and Trudeau, and it's called the Partnership Roadmap. And you know my take on this, the very good, the good, and the empty. Very good to have the ear of the president. Very good to have a close relationship. Good that they're aligned on fundamental things. Empty today will not. The shopping cart will be empty on critical things for Canada, like vaccines. No, we're not getting vaccines from Michigan. No, Keystone's not coming back. No, the Buy American provisions are not going to have a Canadian exemption. So what's the benefit of this? How does this affect you? Well, the smartest person I know on this is Scotty Greenwood. She's a partner at Crestview Strategy and the CEO of the Canadian American Business Council. She's been watching these bilateral neighbor meetings for many, many years, and she joins us now. Scotty, always love having you on the program. Why is this so important, this meeting today?
Well, hey, Evan, I love joining you too.
This is a bilateral for you and I.
You and I. You know, and
yeah, we're having our bilat.
Yeah, you don't call that with your neighbors. I do.
I bet bilats. You do.
We have multi lats.
Yeah. Since the pandemic, we've had no lats.
That's right. Everything's virtual. I don't think that this is empty. I don't accept that as a premise, because one of the things that this particular meeting is going to do that's really different for Canada-U.S., it's something the U.S. has done with other important partners, but hasn't done in my memory for Canada, and that is begin in what we would otherwise call, here's another good diplomatic word, a high-level strategic dialogue. So that's when it's not just the president, the prime minister, it's just not the two amigos or the three amigos in the case of North America, but it's also a big swath of the cabinet from both countries. And so they're going to start the conversation today. They, the two leaders, they're going to bring in cabinet members. They're going to announce blueprints for how we work together. And then those cabinet members are going to be responsible for coming up with action plans and making real progress against the goals that are laid out. So I think this is the beginning of a process. And I think that's good. And that's different, by the way. That's different from previous, you know, grin and grip sessions in the Oval Office or in Ottawa, where you have a 20 or 30 minute meeting, you do the joint presser, and then you go on about your business, and nobody hears about it again until the next bilat. So
that's fair. That's good.
That's useful.
Yeah, I accept that, because there is going to be high-level meetings. There's going to be meetings. And by the way, people, that's important, not just that the two leaders have a relationship, but that the cabinets have a relationship and those are consequential.
Yeah, and Evan, sorry to jump in there, but the cabinet members always do have a relationship with their counterpart, but it's done on a one-off basis, right? So each Canadian cabinet member with their portfolio, you know, reaches out to their U.S. opposite number, and they and it takes, you know, it could take a whole year, right? You got to get the defense secretary's meeting, you got to get the transport secretary's, you got to get the energy ministers. And so this is something different. This is doing it all at once. And so we'll see what comes of it. But I think it's good. I think it's called for. And look, there's also a lot of common ground, notwithstanding your opening there. There are disagreements for sure, and we've got to figure out a way to work through them. But there also is an awful lot of common ground, and we ought to really seize it and make a huge amount of forward progress while we've got it.
Yeah, and I'm speaking to Scotty Greenwood. I agree with that. That's why I say there's a lot of very good here, and there's a lot of good here. But I think there's a lot of people, because you know, when you are in an emergency situation, like a pandemic, and you need vaccines like Canada does, and your neighbor has, vaccinated, you know, 60 times more than you have, and they're producing it. I get their, but the Biden goal, vaccine nationalism is an issue, and that's not going to change today. And people are going to watch for that. Pipeline decisions are not going to change today. People will watch for that. The Buy American provisions are not going to change today. So again, you know, people think, what will Justin Trudeau have to do outside of all the things you've said, which are all true, but to tell people, you know, this relationship is not being written in sand. There's something being written in concrete. What is it?
Well, you know, fair enough. I think what the Prime Minister will have to do is prioritize what Canada wants, right? So Canada, you know, in any relationship, you can't, if you have 20 priorities, you have none, right? You have to say, here is the most important thing to me, or here are the top three. And then the U.S. will say, well, I think we can make progress on this one, but not that one. It, you know, so there's a little bit of a back and forth there. And so I'll be really watching for that, Evan, to see, does the Prime Minister say, you know what, the number one thing for Canada is a Buy American waiver. If he says that, that's, you know, that will create a trajectory. If he says, look, Buy America is important to us, but there are other things that are more important to us, then that'll be that'll be relevant, right? So we just have to sort of see how the Canadian wish list, if you will, is presented. And by the way, the U.S. has a wish list too. The U.S. will, and it typically is more global, more multilateral. So the U.S. will say, you know, we'd really like your help with this big global issue or that big global issue. I mean, both leaders definitely want to talk to each other about China. That's something they have in common.
Yeah, but what could they do on that? Like, we need the three. We need the two Michaels done. There was a vote in Parliament yesterday that there's a genocide that Justin Trudeau actually was absent for, and his foreign affairs minister abstained. But they say we need multilateral action. Is the United States going to lead on that? Join Canada on that?
Well, what they can do is they can have a real frank discussion about what is the community of nations going to do about China, because the two Michael situation is horrendous, but it is only one of a number of things that are happening in China that the world has to deal with. So I think it's about how do you get everybody that agrees with you moving forward together. I think it'll be interesting to also see, for example, if the athletes of the world stand up and say, you know, we really want to go to the Olympics. We've been training our whole lives. We don't want to boycott the Olympics. But how about move the Olympics? Like, why do they have to be in China? And it's one thing for governments to say that, and that's powerful. But you're only ever going to get, you know, what, 60 governments to ever do that? You could get athletes from around the world to say, let's compete somewhere else. Let's go to Calgary. You know, let's go to
Lake
Placid.
It would be great. It would be great to relocate, but it's amazing how you got the Canadian Olympic Committee and others saying, you know, don't make the Olympics political, as if the Olympics aren't already political and China's not clearly using it as a political propaganda tool.
Well, you know, Evan, like I understand the point of view of the kind of powerful people at the top, but what I'm talking about is something a little bit different. If you look at the big movements over the last 10 years, say, whether it's the Arab Spring, whether it's Me Too, Time's Up, Black Lives Matter, these are movements that have been sparked by younger people who care passionately. So anyway,
I agree with that. I love it. I don't want to leave it. I never want the moral, you know, moral to put this on the backs of athletes. But I agree with you. I'd love some leadership there. Scotty,
you know,
Greenwood,
20-something.
Yeah, listen, I
agree. Yeah, go ahead.
Scotty, love having you on. We're looking forward today. Your points are, as ever, very well made. CEO of the Canadian American Business Council, partner at Crestview Strategy US. Hey, thanks, Scotty.
Hey, thanks, Evan. Always great to be with you.
Always good to have a bilat with Scotty Greenwood.
That's right.
A bilat. I love these diplomatic terms. We got to take a break. This is really important, and I've been railing about this. We're going to talk about the vaccine rollout. Why are family doctors being left in the dark? It's outrageous. That next.
helping you through these unique times. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the program, everybody, on a beautiful Tuesday. I was in IKEA this week, and finally, because we were allowed to, so my wife and I had to pick something up, and my kids like those IKEA frozen meatballs, so we bought some of the frozen meatballs. But, of course, in Israel today, you can go to IKEA, and you can get a vaccine. We can get meatballs and a shelving unit, and they can get a vaccine. I'm serious. In Israel today, if you go to IKEA, you can literally get your vaccine at IKEA. Now, you have to assemble the vaccine yourself, and you have to use an Allen key, and probably there's a part missing. No, but I'm actually being serious. You get a vaccine. You will get the Pfizer vaccine if you just go to IKEA in Israel. That's how well-organized Israel is on their vaccine rollout. Their government is talking to IKEA to give its citizens, and guess what? Governments like the Ontario government, Canada's biggest province, is not even talking to its family doctors. Israel's talking to IKEA, and we're not even talking to our family doctors. And then Doug Ford announced, you know, the premier, you know, we're going to vaccinate everyone over 80, which was fantastic, except family doctors didn't even know about it. I literally just got a note from our family doctor saying, oh, yeah, we're not doing that. My dad is over 80. He doesn't know if his family doctor is doing it. And Dr. Michelle Cohen is a family physician in Brighton, Ontario, assistant professor at the Department of Family Medicine at Queen's, and wrote a phenomenal article about something I've been speaking about since last week. Why aren't family doctors being rolled into the plans? Why are they getting blindsided? Let's bring in Dr. Cohen, and thank you for the work. Doc, great to have you on the program. Just tell our listeners, if you can, when you first heard that you are going to be involved in vaccinating people over 80.
Well, so Friday afternoon, the announcement went out at the press conference, and then I started getting messages and noticing on social media my colleagues talking about it, and just sort of this continual asking each other, have you heard about this? Have you heard anything about this? I haven't heard anything about this. And then it was obvious, and even our organizations were saying, after they were being pestered to respond as well by many family doctors asking them to speak for us, saying, we have not heard anything about this plan. Please do not tell people to call our offices and book in for vaccination. It's just going to be a disaster when that happens. I actually had a local colleague tell me that yesterday he had people show up at his clinic before it opened, and they were just waiting outside. And we had a snowstorm in our area yesterday. So there are elderly people coming out in a pandemic, in a snowstorm, go to their family doctor's office because the province has told them that that's where they're going to be vaccinated. So it's just a disaster.
Now, you're actually saying, and you wrote, that this could, and I've talked about this a lot, talking to family doctors are being left in the dark. We've had more press on getting pharmacies involved. I have no problem getting pharmacies involved, but first let's use the public system. First let's use family doctors. First let's use frontline workers before we decide to privatize this, and then we may well need pharmacies. I have no problem with it. But the triage of this is ridiculous. You've actually argued that the vaccine rollout in the province of Ontario is, quote, a deliberate political tactic, the confusion. What do you mean by that, doctor?
Well, so when I say it's a tactic, I don't mean that the province is, you know, somewhere gleefully rubbing their hands together because they've maliciously put out misleading messaging. I think that it takes a lot of effort to make good, clear messages and to get good, accurate information out to the public. And I think the province is not putting in that effort because, frankly, it benefits them politically when people are confused, when they're spending their time and energy calling around different places, navigating our system, which is already a complicated and difficult system to navigate to begin with, and trying to figure out where they or their family members are going to be vaccinated. So when people who are simply trying to survive through the pandemic are spending their time trying to figure out where the accurate information is, that's a lot less energy that can be put into criticizing the government's plan, advocacy to try to, you know, push for change, for something better, or any sort of meaningful organization altogether. It just exhausts everyone who could otherwise be taking action.
Yeah, and let's move back to the confusing message. For people who want this vaccine, of course they're going to go to their family doctor. That's a critical resource. And I know there's been a lot of backroom planning, and I've reported on this a lot, but it seems that family doctors really have no idea when, how, and what role they are going to play. What do you make of that?
Well, it's exactly right. We've been asking since December to be involved in some way, or at least to have some sort of communication, something to get us involved. At one point, there was a form put up that we could sign on to, and then the province was supposed to contact us that we could help out, and that just went nowhere. I think that was pretty much just busy work. So we've been told that our public health, local public health units are going to guide us, and so that's who we're expecting to guide us on this. And they are, and we are putting together a plan, but the community family physicians and the community healthcare providers, so including nurses, nurse practitioners, paramedics, all of these providers are just kind of left out in the cold, and we could be included in a plan, and our offices could be included in the plan. We are connected to thousands of patients in our communities, so we could be brought into planning this, and we're just not. I think we're really just being involved in this most recent announcement to deflect blame, because ultimately when people get confused and frustrated calling around calling around there, trying to figure out what's going on, then the province can blame us for not being part of the plan and not being organized enough, but they haven't really let us into any of this planning that they're doing.
First of all, I think, folks, this is so important, and I'm speaking to Dr. Michelle Cohen, who's a family physician, a professor. Just the idea that doctors are in the dark, that doctors don't know the plan, that doctors feel that they're being sort of thrown under the bus. But it's not just by the province of Ontario and that kind of the fact that you're taken off guard in a major announcement. Patients, you know, elderly patients lining up to get a vaccine that doctors don't have and have no guidance on. That is insane. But it's even the blame game, and you use this term, Doug, the blame game is happening not only at the provincial level, but the federal level. It's like no one cares who's to blame. Patients want clear, simple, basic information. The blame game of politics is really on all levels, isn't it, Doctor?
Right, absolutely. You know, the Ottawa is doing a similar sort of shifting blame downstream, saying, well, you know, we secured the vaccine and now it's up to the provinces to deal with it. And I think that's inadequate. We've had months now where we knew that vaccination was going to be a major strategy to get us out of the pandemic. And in that time, we could have nationalized the strategy. We could have connected to a whole network of providers across this country, including way up in our remote areas, which are going to definitely be underserved. There's always a geographic inequity. There's always people being left out in our rural and most remote regions. So the Ottawa could have absolutely created a plan or unveiled some sort of strategy and signed up some community health providers and gotten them on board with the eventual vaccine rollout. But instead, there was no communication. And when the vaccine showed up, the strategy seemed to basically just be deliver it to the provinces and then just kind of stand back and wash your hands of anything that happens at the lower level. And I think when we're dealing with a huge national crisis like this, that is an inadequate response.
Last question for you, Doc, because I'm going to have another doctor on to talk about the fact that there are 34 different vaccination plans for the province of Ontario. Every health unit is going to have their own plan, which kind of is crazy because I thought there was supposed to be a vaccine task force that was going to have some unified plan. Now it's kind of here, health units, do your thing. So speaking of confusion, how is that going to be communicated? Do you think it's smart to have 34 different plans on the vaccination rollout?
I think it's challenging. You know, it's another example of just kind of shifting the blame downwards to say, well, you know, the local health units are going to deal with it. And there's certainly like there is a level at which local and regionalized planning is helpful, absolutely. But yeah, I think coming up with 34 different plans and each health unit is going to be getting vaccine at a different time because, again, of many of those geographic inequities. So we're going to be seeing different health units working in a different way compared to other ones. Mm. So I think there are some details that can be regionalized in a useful way. But in terms of actually distributing the vaccine, I think a broader strategy is helpful. And when we see things get shifted downwards, I often suspect that deflecting blame is part of the reason.
I'm going to ask you, I got 10 seconds here, but Dr. Michelle Cohen, you should run for politics. Just think about it. That's what I like. We need public smart voices. And has anyone ever told you that?
Actually, yes, but
Think about it. I know Okay. It's like getting your wisdom teeth pulled, but we need it. You're the best. Thank you, Doc. I really appreciate
much.
It. I'm serious. Think about it. You're a hell of a communicator. Look at that. Smart, tough, accomplished. We got Dr. Isaac Bogosh on the other side to talk more about this. Stay with us. Lots to come.
From coast to coast to coast, the newsmakers talk here. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the show on a beautiful Tuesday. We all want the vaccine? Yes. We're all in this together? Yes. But let's be candid. I said this yesterday. We're continuing our theme today. There's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of blaming going on. And we just talked to the great Dr. Michelle Cohen, who's a family physician and a professor. And she said, look, this is a joke. Family doctors like her were caught off guard on Friday in Ontario. They didn't even know that they were supposed to be vaccinating people over 80. The announcement just came. She had patients lined up in the cold outside her office saying, oh, okay, we're ready. She's like, we're not vaccinating yet. We didn't even hear about this till Friday. No one's talked to us. Confusion. Lack of preparation. And now we hear that Ontario is going to have 34 different COVID vaccination plans. Because all different models are going to have, every regional health center is going to have a different model. Now, yeah, North Bay has a different need than Ottawa or Thunder Bay in Ontario. But I thought there was supposed to be a vaccination task force that's going to have a central location. And my concern is there's going to be inequities. This is a way of forestalling and evading responsibility if things don't go well. Well, it's not up to us. It's local. Like, this should, in my view, very much be the jurisdiction of the province. So Dr. Isaac Bogosh, infectious disease physician at the Toronto General Hospital, great guy, member of the COVID-19 vaccine task force, may be able to clear it all up for us. Doc, always a pleasure to have you on the program. I appreciate your time and the great work you do. What's the deal with 34 different vaccination plans? It sounds, I'm telling you, it sounds crazily confusing.
Yeah, so I'm not entirely pleased with how this is framed. Like, we have to, there's a central playbook. There's a central rule book. There's a central theme. There's a central system for prioritization, for an ethical framework for how this is going to be rolled out. But as you point out, Ontario's huge. The difference, you know, there's a big difference in vaccinating, you know, communities north of Kenora compared to vaccinating people in downtown Toronto. Different demographic, different geographic hurdles, different barriers to care. So this, all that happens is the 34 public health units submitted plans to say, hey, here's how we think we can care for the communities we represent. Here's how we can best vaccinate the communities we represent, because there's different communities in different parts of the province. Spoiler alert, it's very, very similar, right? Everyone has some degree of mass vaccine site, community centers, primary care, pharmacies, mobile trucks to vaccinate homeless and underhoused communities. Everyone has some element of this, but like, why would you centralize? Why would you have me make a decision about where a vaccine site should be placed in North Bay? I don't know. It's not my job. That's clearly public health in North Bay would be best to address that. So that's why they made their plans. And that's why you have local public health leaders making local plans, because public health at the end of the day is local. So there's a centralized playbook, centralized set of expectations, centralized priority list, centralized ethical framework. But it, of course, is applied locally.
Yeah, but listen to what I'm getting. These are listeners right now, as you're speaking, Dr. Bogosh, texting me at 71010 or calling in at 1-855-633-1010. Evan, I'm in Prince Edward Hastings. Our health unit has already provided a vaccine rollout list and booked the local arenas. They're organized. But then how about this? Evan, I've contacted my regional health unit. They have no information to offer at all. Evan, most family doctor offices are closed. How can people get the COVID vaccine, says Jay. I could tell you, I could read confused messages, and I think people want equality, they want clarity, they want assurances, and I really do believe that, look, I understand that every community has different health needs, but the problem is this, that I think this is an abdication of a central responsibility to get the, listen, you plug and play to adjust to your circumstance, but there should be a central much bigger plan and not 34 different plans that people are like, I have no idea, because the messages are already mixed up.
No, I love you to pieces, but I disagree with this. Like, first of all, give it a minute, right? like, give it a minute. There's communication coming this week about how this next phase will roll out. How do you sign up? How do you mobilize? How do you get 80-year-olds, you know, signed up and mobilized to a vaccine center? You know, it's coming. It's coming this week.
But it's coming this week. But it has taken. Let's be fair. It's coming on the same week that we got 640,000 vaccines. Like, what has taken so long? You got to admit, it's weirdly late, and it doesn't give you a long communications runway here.
No, it doesn't. Listen, if we're talking about communications, that's a different story. I could talk about communications from political leaders, from public health leaders. We could go for days on that. Let's talk about plans, right? Public health is local. Public health is local. You've got to apply it locally. You've got and you know, obviously the communication is crucial. It's a crucial component to it. Give it a minute. Wait till the communication comes out and tell how people can understand how they can sign up, get people signed up, get people mobilized to a vaccine center. Okay, of course there's going to be bumps on the road. It's not going to be seamless, but you can sort of predict what those are going to be ahead of time and iron them out.
But
how this is going to be. Yeah,
but it's not just Ontario. Like, we have listeners in Victoria, Vancouver, Kelowna. John Horgan, the premier of BC, I'm quoting him from the Vancouver Sun. I understand and appreciate the anxiety and frustration. People are living in a vacuum of information. He said it's about a lack of information. He's talking about mass vaccinations in April. Like, I got to tell you, people have been doing the right thing. They're waiting. They're scared of new variants. They can't figure out whether we should open or close. Public health is saying closed. Politicians are saying we should start opening. We hear the government saying, hey, we're going to hit our vaccine targets. Everything's great. There's like the average person listening is like, I've been doing my job. Why can't I find out when? Yeah, they're vaccinating in IKEA in Israel today. We don't even have family doctors with information.
Listen, at the end of the day, I think a lot of this concern would be alleviated by clear communication. And I think we've had this conversation about 100 times. You get the same person at the same place at the same time every single day because it's a crisis. You need crisis communications. Same person, same place, same time every single day to give an update and to answer questions to the media. And guess what? If you don't know the answer, you got 24 hours to figure it out because you're going to be at the same place at the same time tomorrow. Every single crisis times, and this is a crisis, calls for crisis communication strategies.
And I think clarity. Just clarity, transparency.
Total transparency. What do you know? What do you don't know? What you don't know? And when are you going to figure this out? Easy peasy. And that would, I really truly think, that would take about 50% of the pressure and alleviate about 50%. There's real concerns out there. Don't get me wrong.
But a lot
of it is just because of communication.
Well, I got to tell you one thing. Love having you on because I can't, I mean this as it's so important that you come on, you do your job communicating, you take the questions. Dr. Isaac Bogosh, you are really a superb communicator as well as a great doctor. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. Guys, we got to take a break. When we come back, grilling the liberals on the Chinese genocide.
You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back. So Justin Trudeau is going to meet with Joe Biden today, and they're going to talk about China. And yesterday, Parliament voted overwhelmingly, 266-0, that China is committing a genocide against the Muslim minority Uyghur population in Western China. Who wasn't there? Justin Trudeau and the entire cabinet, except for the Foreign Affairs Minister Mark Carney, who abstained. But the entire cabinet just didn't show up. Now, I said this on the radio station yesterday. I didn't think they're not going to vote for it, but I thought they'd abstain or just not show, and that's exactly what happened. But the Conservatives, the NDP, the Bloc, the Greens, they all voted to say that what is going on with the Uyghurs, which a parliamentary subcommittee on foreign affairs has said is a genocide, which Erwin Kotler, the former Liberal justice minister and an expert on this, the head of the Raoul Wallenberg Center, rises to the crime according to the 1948 Convention Against Genocide signed by Canada. This is a genocide according to all those people. There's rape, there's mass incarceration, there's a million people at least in work camps, there's population control, all meets that threshold. But Justin Trudeau decided in a profile of courage not even to show up, not to explain why. Now, remember, this is not a person that is adverse to saying there's a genocide. In 2019, Justin Trudeau said he accepted the findings of a national inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women right here in Canada. And he said the word, "We believe this is a genocide." Listen.
We recognize the need for a national public inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And we have commissioners who came back with findings of fact and with calls to action. We thank them for their work, we applaud their work, and we accept their findings, including that what happened amounts to genocide.
What happens amounts to genocide, not cultural genocide, genocide. Now, to be fair to the Liberals, once a government says that China is committing a genocide, you are obliged to do more than just boycott Olympics or move the Olympics. You should be boycotting other things. And the Conservatives and the NDP have to really get their game on that. They have to decide if that's what they really want. And I do believe we need an international consensus on this. But at least using the Olympics has raised the awareness of this. Yesterday, though, I asked the Foreign Affairs critic, Minister Mark Garner, to come on. He abstained. But the Liberals said, okay, but you know who you can talk to? You can talk to a lawyer. Liberal MP Ali Essassi. Mr. Essassi is a very smart man. He's a lawyer. He also did not vote. 66 Liberals voted with this. So, you know, most of the Liberals there are voting with the motion against their own government. But I asked him to begin, why did the Prime Minister and all of Cabinet not just abstain, why didn't they even show up for a very important vote?
Well, Evan, first of all, I think it's important to point out that the government will obviously be very much guided by the debate that took place today. It was a robust debate, and I can only speak for myself. The reason why I abstained is, as someone who has practiced international law, has done international litigation, it was quite obvious to me that the facts that have emerged are unconscionable, they're egregious, but they do not fit the precise definition of genocide. Had the Conservatives decided to say that these were crimes against humanity, absolutely would have voted for them. But in good conscience, right, understanding the definitions, understanding the case law, I could not bring myself to do so.
Right. So can I just ask you then, Erwin Kotler, the former justice minister, does believe it rises to the threshold of the 1948 Convention Against Genocide. And sir, let me just ask you, in 2019, Prime Minister Trudeau said Canada had committed a genocide after the report on missing and murdered Indigenous women. He said the words, "Canada committed a genocide. We accept the findings, including what happened, that amounts to genocide." So Canada has committed a genocide, you're saying, as a liberal, and you're saying China against the Uyghurs, the evidence you've seen there, does not rise to that level. You're saying that?
Well, first of all, let me say, Evan, that there is a very robust debate that is going on amongst scholars and people who understand international law. And there is absolutely no consensus at this part that what we have seen emerge, although it has been horrific, it has been terrible, and it should be condemned, that it constitutes genocide. In addition to that, you raise the question of cultural genocide. Let me point out clearly that the International Law Commission has actually delved into this issue, as have decisions of the International Court for Yugoslavia. And they did determine that cultural genocide is not the same as genocide, as specifically.
But you know, sir, I'm just saying, so you're saying, I just want to press you on this. I'm going to quote the Prime Minister in 2019. "We accept their findings, including that what
happened amounts to genocide. He didn't say cultural genocide. He said amounts to genocide. Are you now saying that the prime minister made a mistake?
What I am saying
genocide,
is that they...
Or the genocide in Canada is different than what your government considers the non-genocide taking place in China.
Well, again, I just want to reiterate, Evan, that the definition of genocide is well settled. It's something that many people will disagree with. And that's precisely why you have not seen other countries come to that conclusion. That is precisely why you have not seen international organizations come to a consensus as to whether the factual matrix, which is horrific, emerging from China, constitutes genocide. That's the reality of it. And our government will be guided by the debate that took place today. As you know, the Prime Minister did bring it up in his virtual G7 meeting. Bob Rae has been leading discussions at the United Nations, and we will continue to do so.
Okay, last question. How is the Prime Minister and the Cabinet going to be guided by a debate that they didn't show up to listen to?
Well, as you know, as the situation evolves, as maybe perhaps more information does become available, this could very well crystallize into what is considered genocide. But at this particular point, as you know full well, Evan, there is no consensus. There's been no consensus at the legal department of the State Department or in any other country.
Right.
This has come before the British House of Commons. There, again, there was no consensus.
Yeah. First of all, is there a consensus? Well, they're moving towards a consensus. He's not wrong on that. First of all, we're going to be guided by this. You got to show up to a debate to be guided. You can't. You know, I'm really listening to you closely. By the way, I didn't even show up. The fact that they didn't show up, they didn't listen, they didn't even bother to show. How can you be guided by that debate, number one? Number two, Justin Trudeau said that Canada's committing a genocide, not a cultural genocide. Three, cultural genocide, I understand the legal principles that Mr. Assassi talked about. Cultural genocide is a component of genocide, which is an all-encompassing term. And finally, four, the idea that Canada, that this is unsettled and that there's, for example, the State Department, yes, they've debated, although Mike Pompeo, the former Secretary of State on the last day of the Trump administration, declared that. I thought that he shouldn't have done that on the last day. There is going to be pressure on China. Let me just tell you what I think Justin Trudeau needs to do. He doesn't need to jump on board this. He needs to work with Joe Biden today on a multilateral approach, but he needs to show that he's serious. How do you do that? He has to say, okay, we are moving towards a multilateral approach to China regarding the Uyghurs. We demand, one, a boycott of all goods coming out of there. They've talked about that already. Two, we are going to ban Huawei from our 5G. Three, we are going to pull our investment out of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank that we... Do that and show that you're ready to take a tougher stance against China. But if you won't make a decision on Huawei, you won't make a decision on the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and you won't take tougher sanctions on trade out of Western China, then we can't take it seriously that you're going to make a move on the genocide. You have to show serious intent. All right, we're going to take a break. Thanks for being with me on that. Lots to come.
Sorting through the changes. Here's Evan Solomon.
Happy Tuesday, everybody. So, you know, I have a long-standing rule here, and I don't care how, quote, politically correct people think it is. Don't use people for your logos. Sports teams that use groups as their logo, got to stop it. Cleveland Indians. Nope. Got to stop. Washington. I don't even like to say that name. Nope. I told you I wouldn't want someone to say, hey, we're going to be the Brooklyn Jews. And it's like, but it's a great, proud picture of a Jewish guy. Sorry. Not for me. I just don't think you should do it. sports teams don't need to appropriate. And now that happened, you know, McGill, even though the Redmen, you know, I went to McGill, the Redmen changed their name. It didn't even refer to anything. It actually referred to something else, but it was construed later to deal with Aboriginal peoples, and they changed it. It was offensive. What's the big deal? Now, Jeep Cherokee, the famous line of Jeep, have been criticized by the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, who said, stop using the name on your SUVs. I think we're in a day and age in this country where it's time for both corporations and sports teams to retire the use of Native American names, images, and mascots for their products, team jerseys, and sports in general. I'm sure this comes from a place that is well-intentioned, but it does not honor us by having our name plastered on the side of a car, said Chuck Hoskin, Jr., principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. Now, we asked the principal chief to join us. He couldn't make it today. And Car and Driver published a response from Jeep. And I'm going to play it for you. Here's what Jeep said. Our vehicle names have been carefully chosen and nurtured over years to honor and celebrate Native American people and their nobility, prowess, and pride. We are more than ever committed to a respectful and open dialogue with the Cherokee Nation. And then they said, this is one of our most valuable parts of our identity in an interview, right? They said, this is really key. So Jeep's really committed to this. Jeep says, this is such an important part of our identity since they first used the name Cherokee in 1974, right? I mean, people are going to say, but it's so great. This is such an important part of Jeep, right? The Cherokee is so key. Except it wasn't that important to Jeep Cherokee. They stopped using it in 1993. They dropped the, quote, Cherokee model. So it's not like the name is that important. They only decided to reintroduce it 8 years ago, 7.5 years ago in 2013, for a new compact SUV. So it's not like, let's be honest, it's not like the word Cherokee is that important to Jeep. It's not like they've coveted this and nurtured this. They actually didn't even use it. In 1993, they dumped it. And then they decided, well, we should re... So it's not that important to Jeep. So I just want to ask you, should the name Cherokee be removed from Jeep's name? I don't think Jeep is using it in a derogatory name. I just think they shouldn't be appropriating the name of a people to use their product. 1-855-633-1010, 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Let me know what you think. Pam Palmiter, Mi'kmaq lawyer and chair of the Indigenous Governance at Ryerson University, joins us. Pam, first of all, I hope you're well. Been a little while since we've spoken. You know my stance on this. Do you think Jeep should be not using the word Cherokee?
Of course. I mean, literally everything you said. First of all, they have no understanding of Cherokee culture or naming processes or what's behind it or what it signifies. They never had consent. You can't honor someone you don't actually talk to and see if they want that. There's certainly been no profit sharing. I mean, it's pure cultural appropriation for profit, saying Native voices don't count on this. And I think the entire planet has changed. Like you said, this has got to go. I mean, this was not only foreseeable, but they should have got ahead of it and shown that they were, you know, conscientious about not appropriating culture. Instead, they're fighting it as if it's their identity to hold on to.
Yeah, I mean, this is just so, like, I get it. Some people are going to say, oh, everyone's so sensitive. First of all, people who get upset about this, it's not like they have stock invested in Jeep. Jeep doesn't seem to even care about this name. It's not that important name to Jeep. If this was Jeep's entire heritage, then they wouldn't have dumped the name in 1993. Like this is clearly a logo. I get that it's been a brand. I don't think that Jeep is using it as a intentional form of denigration. But as you say, Pam, like, we just got to stop this. This is an out-of-date practice to start taking. Yeah. And people say, oh, but we're honoring the Cherokee Nation as proud and noble. Well, thanks. You can certainly do that.
Stealing is not honoring. Stealing without sharing the profits is not honoring. I mean, literally, there's trillions of options for names and logos and brands, and companies change names all the time, and there's new, you know, social media, corporate media companies that do that for a living. Go pay someone to find a flashy new name and a flashy new vehicle. I mean, people would forget about it all of a sudden, but they act like it's their identity to protect. And it's
happens not just here, like Uncle Ben's, Aunt Jemima syrup, Uncle Ben. Like, there's a point where people say, you know what? Okay.
Enough.
The product can remain the same, people. There's no, but just stop using other people as your corporate logo. I'm with, like, use anything. There's, you know, you get, you know, like, literally, we have a football team called the Red Blacks. Like, it's just colors here. Use color. They're great. The Red Sox, pretty successful name. You know?
It's like, crazy. And think about, like, all of the options. There's literally endless options. And here's the other thing. They could actually win some customers and some loyalty by getting out ahead of it. Instead, the companies that fight it and change later, they just look like they were begrudged and they will have lost lots of customers. All of these companies, and there's a lot more than just these ones that we're talking about, this is foreseeable. This is the way of human rights and respect and decolonization,
right?
Although, honoring Native people.
Okay, well, Pam Palmer, I love having you on. I totally agree with Pam, but the texts that are coming through, Evan, people are overreacting. I like when people are explaining to the Cherokee that the Cherokees are overreacting. Political correctness gone berserk. Why? What do you have at stake here? Why is this appropriation? It's honoring. How do you know what's honoring?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I just don't get that. Pam, let me take some calls on this. People are like, oh my God, what's the world coming to? You know, let me just answer it. The world is coming to respect. It's not so hard. Katie, you're on the line. I think the world's just coming to, this is not a big deal to me, but people go crazy on this. Katie, what's your take on this?
First of all, we probably should be hearing from the Indigenous people, which, I mean, I work with them as a therapist.
Pam Palmiter is
okay,
a Mi'kmaq lawyer.
I'm not talking about her. I'm not just talking about her. I'm talking about thousands and thousands that live on the reserve. They have zero issues with this whatsoever. Not even that. I mean, they want to change where I live in Dundas. They want to change our name Dundas after Henry Dundas. Like, get over yourself. History. Nobody cares. We have bigger problems in the world than this. Changing a name. Get over yourself.
Okay, well, thank you for the comment. What does get over yourself mean? Like, who are you to, first of all, like, you're telling people that they don't care. What do you mean get over yourself? Like, history matters. My question is, when people say this is history, whose history? Yeah. History's written. It's a perspective here, folks.
And we wish it was history. Hello, ongoing genocide. Canada's been found guilty of not just historic, but ongoing genocide. If only we could get over it. If only all of this racism and violence would stop. That would be great. But that's not our lived reality.
Yeah, Pam Palmer, I appreciate you. Someone's actually saying Jeep must absolutely stop using the name. Perfect example of privilege if they continue using it. What I just can't get is how exercised people get over these things. Mm-hmm. Like, this is about respect. Just don't use someone's people and someone's heritage as your slogan to profit from. Why is that so hard? All right, I got to take a break. When we come back, you're going to have a shocking story about vaccinations with the elderly, and it's not COVID-related for a change.
Making sense of the latest news. You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the program. Now, there's an obsession with vaccines right now. There's an obsession with vaccines. Of course there is. Everybody wants their COVID vaccine. And if you don't live in Israel and can't get it at the local IKEA, you're out of luck. Literally, they're giving them out at IKEA there. I'll take the Hoogland shelf. I'll take the Boglin chair. Yeah, I'll take the Pfizer vaccine too. I'll just assemble it myself, put the needle together, mix the serum, and inject myself. Yeah, they're doing that in Israel today. They're that well organized. You and I are just sitting in our houses, but they're like, hey, let's go to IKEA, get the bookshelf, the meatballs, and I'll take the shot too. Why not? But let's talk about vaccines that are not COVID related, because everyone's so obsessed about seniors. Oh, we've got to take care of seniors in long-term care homes. We know that's an empty promise. Oh, we've got to make sure seniors are vaccinated. That's getting better, only after we let long-term care homes become petri dishes of death. Not to be dramatic, but that's what it has been. Colossal negligence. But now it turns out that more is revealed about our negligence, that we don't even vaccinate seniors at all. Seniors are running around basically without getting their vaccines. Their shingles, painful. Don't get that. And there's now a report card out, the first report card of its kind, on how badly our country vaccinates its seniors. And to talk, like, this is incredible. Like, the pandemic is ripping back the curtain on what's really happening. And a society is judged by how it takes care of its elderly and its children. And by that standard, it ain't going well. Laura Tamblyn-Watts is the CEO of CanEdge, Canada's National Seniors Advocacy Organization, who put this report together. And Laura is a good friend of our show. So great to have you back on the show. What has this revealed, this report card on non-COVID vaccinations?
We have fundamentally failed Canadian seniors and have been failing them for decades. The overall grade for how we do in Canada for adult vaccination is a D-, and the best score is only a B-. Seniors aren't getting the very basic vaccinations they need. In fact, we only have about 10% of Canadian seniors vaccinated for what they're supposed to be vaccinated for. We're supposed to have that at about 90%.
Okay, so can you give me the scorecards? Let's run through what we're missing here.
We focus primarily on shingles, influenza, and pneumonia, the top three that hit seniors the hardest. And then we also looked at some of the other vaccines like diphtheria and tetanus and so on, which we cover well, but we found out that even though they're covered, older people don't have them. What we found as a top line is that only two provinces in Canada provide the specifically formulated influenza vaccine that's for seniors. Only two of them. We do provide them in long-term care homes. About half the provinces have done that prior to this year. And this year, the federal government provided funding for that specifically formulated influenza vaccine on a one-time basis. But right now, older people, year after year, are not getting the influenza vaccine they need. Shingles vaccine is only covered for 5 years of what's supposed to be everyone 50 plus, so just 65 to 70 in only two different jurisdictions, and our influenza
vaccine. Yeah, Ontario and Yukon on that one. Crazy.
Yeah, it is Ontario and the Yukon. And then for the specifically formulated seniors influenza, it's Ontario and PEI. So we are shockingly behind where we need to be and an embarrassment globally.
And whose accountability is this? Is this the provinces just failing?
Combination of failure. We've seen that the federal government can purchase and organize vaccines and distribute them to the province. They've been doing that with COVID, and they did that on a one-time basis, again, for the specifically formulated influenza vaccine for people in long-term care. They can do it, but they haven't been doing it. It's been left to the provinces, who then download it to local health authorities to spend what they need to spend on vaccines, and we know that they're the very first thing that gets cut. So the funding is very inconsistent across this country. And then in provinces like Ontario, where the funding isn't bad, the access is terrible. So Ontario got an F for access. We make it hard for people to get vaccinated, even when it's covered.
I want people to understand why this is important. If you don't prevent preventable illnesses like influenza, shingles, and pneumonia, just to take the most common infectious diseases, what happens is people get sick. And not only are they suffering, but they go into the healthcare system and it costs millions and millions of dollars. In other words, when you don't take preventative action, you pay on the other end astronomically.
This is a matter of life and death for seniors, but it's also a matter of life and death for our healthcare system and our economy. And COVID-19 has laid bare how vulnerable we are to vaccine-preventable diseases. This report shows that even for the ones that we do have, we're still doing a terrible job. So our healthcare system is buckling under the downflow effects of vaccine-preventable diseases. And people who get specifically seniors who get shingles, pneumonia, and influenza, in many cases, never recover.
I want to just run the scorecard. For our listeners in BC, if you're listening to us in the beautiful city of Vancouver or Kelowna or Victoria, you got a D-. If you're listening in Alberta, a D+. Same with Saskatchewan, D+, D in Manitoba. Hey, Ontario, you got a B-. Actually, the best score outside of PEI. But access, you got an F. Quebec, CJAD, D-. And outside of PEI, everyone else, an F in some places. Like Nunavut. Wow. Newfoundland, F. Newfoundland, F. These are terrible scores. These are terrible scores. This is an embarrassment, Laura Tamblyn-Watts. So the overall, our seniors are way more vulnerable than we thought.
And we can prevent this easily. The solution is actually easy and clear. It's just a matter of doing it. It's our recommendation that the federal government order and purchase the vaccines for 80 to 90% herd immunity. That's what they're supposed to be. That's what the World Health Organization and NACI says we're supposed to have. And then transfer those vaccines down to the provinces for distribution. If they did that and all NACI recommended vaccines were covered, it would still only cost 1.5% of the federal drug budget. So it's easy to fix. At least, if nothing else, every province should be looking at this report card in horror and making sure that they fund and follow the recommendations we have for accessibility and information. Yeah. So the good news, bad news story is this. It's terrible, but it can get better.
And by the way, NASI, folks, is the National Advisory Committee on Immunization. My mom just texted me, okay, and I'm going to read you my mom. When it came to the flu vaccine in Ontario last fall, they didn't have enough seniors vaccine, so we had to get the regular one. They didn't even have the seniors vaccine for them.
So we know it's critically important that vaccines get into the hands of the people and into the arms of the seniors specifically for the type of vaccine they needed. So an older person like your mom should be getting specifically formulated vaccine. But we know that in the Ontario government, they did not put the order in for more than about 40% of the population and less of that for the seniors vaccine. Mm-hmm. So what we need to do is take the percentage that we want to have vaccinated and yeah. order that number. What I'm really worried about is because flu this year has been very low due to COVID, that they will again look back on this year and order even less vaccines.
Yeah, that's going to be for a shortage next year. Laura Tamblyn-Watts, CEO of CanAge, with this incredible scorecard. And Mom, I hope it was worth it to intervene like that. Get Laura Tamblyn-Watts not only to talk about it, but to say an older person. I mean, Laura, you're going to hear from my mother.
I would love to hear from your mother. She's the kind of person who we need to raise up their voices and demand change of their
government. Well, I'll connect you to my mom. Once my mom's involved, everything's going to change. Trust me. Laura Tamblyn-Watts, you're great. No, but your work is – that was super enlightening, Laura. I love having you on. We're going to talk about screen addiction next. I'm going to put it to you.
As your world changes, we adapt to get your answers. Now more with Evan Solomon.
All right, we always try to end on something a little collective here, a little smiley. Since the New Year's break, we're trying to get a little healthy. You know, COVID is tricky. You got to do exercise. So, you know, Tam and I, my wife, we've decided to get on this kind of, you know, try to get a little healthy. Eat a little better, exercise every day. I've been inspired by a colleague of mine, Graham Richardson, who's the anchor at CTV News Ottawa, who's been exercising for like 365 days, a really great guy and an inspiration. So, you know, we're trying to, you know, come through this pandemic healthy. And I think it's really good for mental health. I mean, if I don't go for a run or do some exercise every day, I really get anxiety. Like it just, I really, I'm a terrible sleeper as it is, but I, you know, exercise for me is just medicine. And so we always talk about that. But then the next thing happens. Like, we know we all have our addictions and all those things. And one of them that we all are getting is screen addictions. Like, the one thing about the pandemic, and I've noticed it with, for me, my wife and our kids, for my friends, like all the conversations, did you watch this? People are like blowing through the Netflix, blowing through the Crave catalog, blowing through Disney Plus, blowing through Amazon Prime. First of all, it's costing us all a fortune. And kids are doing it. Since last March, kids tech firm Super Awesome found screen time was up 50%. 50%. So I was thinking about this, and I was thinking maybe we should go on a screen diet. Not a, look, I'm not going to, like after 8 o'clock, try to cut down on what you're watching. But man, you're tired. And you want to watch it, and there's a lot of great stuff, and you're paying for it, and you just want to sit with your little screen, and, you know, your wife's on one, or your partner's on, and then, you know, you get addicted to a series. So I'm starting to go on a little bit of a screen diet. Here's a couple of my things that I'm doing right now. And this is funny from a guy who, you know, I make my livelihood in television, but it's not like I'm saying no, but I'm trying to read at night more. That's the first thing. I'm trying to make sure that I'm not going to bed watching screens because it's bad for my sleep, but reading. So first of all, I'm trying to read more. And number two, I'm trying not to get involved in like a bit, like one of my kids got involved in the Game of Thrones, my oldest daughter. I have a daughter and a son. My oldest child, who's a daughter, she just, and you know, that's like 8 seasons, and I can't do it. I don't want to get into a TV show or a series that requires that I watch it and binge for hours and hours. So I'm on a 6-part or less diet if I watch a series. I'm trying to watch shorter things so I don't have to keep coming back to it with the addicts, like I need another hit, and I'm trying to read more. Do you have a screen addiction? Are you trying to cut down? 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. I'm just intrigued. Like, are you binging like crazy? 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Do you just find that's all you do? You wake up, you get your screen hit, you go to bed, you get your screen hit. It's really, really hard to resist. And I'm having a hard time with it. So I'm just trying to, you know, a little exercise. And what's happened was I really stopped reading for a little while. I was just like, wow, screens are so great. Like, we don't have a TV in our bedroom. I don't know about you. But I thought that was a great hedge against, but it doesn't matter now because we all have our little iPads and then that's it, you know, or whatever, you know, your computer. So you can stream anywhere and kids and adults are trying to figure this out. So I just want to know, do you have a screen addiction? Are you trying to go on a screen diet? 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. And I don't care if it's cold turkey. Like, no long series after 8 p.m. No watching after 9 p.m. Evan, my daughter is watching Bones the entire 10 seasons, 3 times over, I think. She's got a problem. Like, once you get into these series, you know, people say, hey, did you watch that? I said, I just can't. I'm sure it's great. I don't have 57 hours. Hannah, our producer, said she's watching Netflix every night because there's nothing else to do. No, I'm not going to try to cut back because until the pandemic's over. Oh, okay. 7-10-10. Yeah, look, I don't want to blame people because the pandemic is hard. Mark, you're on the line. It's hard. So I'm not trying to shame people. I'm trying to share that I'm concerned about it for me. What's up, Mark?
Yeah, well, honestly, I was listening to your show. Love your show, Evan. Thanks so much.
Thanks,
honestly,
man.
those are some good tips you had in terms of trying to read at night. I'm actually trying to do those myself. But I found over this quarantine, I've developed a screen addiction in ways that I never even thought was possible. in in ways that had just probably solely developed because of the fact I've been spending so much time at home. One of them has been looking at fantasy hockey stats. And,
My son's into that. My son's in a fantasy, and he loves it. And I'm giving him joy. So what do you say? Stop it? That's pretty fun.
You know what? At least in my head, I'm not putting money down, and you know, it really ties into those sort of same type of kind of gambling addiction types of ways that they work our brains, right? So at least I'm not wagering money. You know, I'm watching the sports and watching the fantasy hockey, and then, you know, now I found myself, I wake up, you know, at the night, and I just found myself checking at my phone at night, which I've never, ever done, just to see, did that player get an assist, because it was a late night game. So it's quite interesting.
Yeah, well, listen, first of all, I love sports, too, and, you know, so I get what you're talking about. I love it, but thanks. And, you know, once you get into fantasy leagues, it's great. It's fun. But, you know, you realize this takes over. And then you get a series. And I appreciate the call, Mark. And I got so many people here saying, Evan, I'm binging everything on Netflix. I have my smartphone on in bed and it's dark, which feels so wrong. I know. Like, it's crazy. Evan, my daughter put a clear plastic bag over her phone and took it into the shower. Oh, my God. It's true. But someone else says, Evan, replace hours and hours with what? Once this pandemic is over, then I'll diet the life-saving screen time. Don't make me feel guilty. I don't want you to feel guilty. But I'm just trying to say, like, it's hard. Like, you know, I play guitar. I'm trying to play guitar. But I tell you, screen time's cutting into that. I try to play every night. I'm just trying to little things. Like, I'm not saying give it up. And I don't want to be that dink that says, you know, like, nah, you should feel guilty. But I do feel it's a bit like, I don't know, it's a bit like exercise. Evan, I'm just buying a 65-inch television for the bedroom as we speak. Listen, I know it's great. And what would we have done without it? Don't get me wrong. I think streaming has saved us. But it's tricky. Evan, people are saying one of my teammates said they binge watch a CTV News Channel Power Play. Ha! I wish. But you can if you want. That would be good. Evan, my wife and I are binge watching Breaking Bad for the third time. I got to be honest, I have never seen Breaking Bad. Do I have time for Lynn? Real quick. Lynn, go for it.
Hi. You're talking about binge-watching on everything, and I'm thinking, what am I missing out on? I hear you guys talking about all these programs. I'm thinking, what am I missing out on? See, I don't have cable, and I don't have internet, so the best I can do is go through all my bookcases, and I've read everything at least 20 times.
Well, Lynn, you're the best. See, there's Lynn. She's managed the pandemic without internet. Lynn, thank you. I got to run. Listen, we're all doing our best. No judgments. Thanks for listening on the iHeartRadio. Talk radio is good. I'll see you on Power Play tonight.